Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
The late 70s Foreigner hit was stuck in Robert Wright's head on his first ever meditation retreat. We'll talk about what he experienced there and what he believes about Buddhist meditation. He writes, "Buddhism offers an explicit diagnosis of the problem and a cure. And the cure, when it works, brings not just happiness, but clarity of vision." As Mr. Wright joins us, I'd like to hear from you. Have you struggled to find that clarity through meditation? And what has meditative practice meant in your everyday life, especially when things seem particularly troubling, as they do on a day like this? Talk to me about your meditative practices and how you find that clarity and that calm in the midst of a pretty troubled world. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Robert Wright is a visiting professor of science and religion at Union Theological Seminary. His books include The Moral Animal. His new book is titled Why Buddhism is True, and he joins us now. And Robert Wright, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Did you meditate this morning?
I did meditate this morning.
Do you meditate every morning?
Pretty much, unless I'm, you know, if I'm traveling, sometimes my practice gets disrupted, but yeah.
Do you find that it is, when the world seems chaotic around you, difficult to get into that meditative place and find that calming space?
It is harder, yeah. And when your own life is turbulent, it's harder. And so that usually means it takes longer before your mind actually calms down. But if you have a regular practice, usually you can get there eventually. I mean, if I do 30 minutes a morning, and usually, it may take, I mean, my mind just may wander for the first 5 minutes and before I even remember that I'm supposed to be meditating and focusing on my breath or whatever. But if you do it regularly, you know, the more regularly you do it, the easier it is to get into the groove each day.
So do your emotions of, I don't know, whatever was happening in your life or around you make it more difficult when you wake up in the morning to say, I have to push some of that away. Here's the practice of what I do to be able to do that. I guess I wonder if some days are more challenging than others.
Well, some days are more challenging, but the approach is never to push this stuff away, because there's a real irony about the way mindfulness meditation works, which is that if you have troublesome feelings like anxiety or stress or remorse or sadness, the idea isn't that you kind of try to get away from them, which is what normally you do. That's the reflex, is to try to make unpleasant feelings go away. The idea is you actually just kind of accept them, even in a sense get closer to them and examine them more closely without any kind of fear of them. And then ironically, that can actually give you a critical distance from them in a sense. So
Can I say that this is what I thought was so interesting, this contradiction that you've just described. It's this, you're seeking serenity and enlightenment. You have to be able to face your pain and your anxiety to do that.
Yeah, and it seems strange that getting closer to these feelings and experiencing them in a sense more deeply would lead you to a point where you can look at them more objectively, after which they cause you less suffering and have less of a grip on you and are no longer controlling your thoughts the way they were. That seems ironic, but that's the way it is. I mean, that's just the way it works. And, you know, people can, you know, a lot of people have trouble meditating. I had a lot of trouble meditating before I finally went to a silent meditation retreat. But one thing people can do is just wait for the occasion. So if you're feeling very sad, just sit down, close your eyes, and examine the sadness. Don't worry about focusing on your breaths or getting into some kind of special state. Just sit down, and rather than think, I wish the sadness would go away, or rather than follow the thoughts that the sadness is generating, just examine the sadness and try that and see how, if you do that for 5 or 10 minutes, that changes your relationship to the sadness.
Call here from Sigrid in Minneapolis. Hi, Sigrid. It sounds like you've been studying meditation. Is that right?
Yes, I've been a member at Clouds and Water, Soto Zen Buddhist Center for several years. I practice kind of more alive.
Sigrid, your phone's cutting in and out. Are you there? Okay, you may have to call us back. I think she was going to talk to us about the practice of appreciating every moment and the awareness that those moments are fleeting and can't be recaptured. I hope I'm paraphrasing what she wanted to say.
No, that's interesting because that's one thing you most commonly hear about mindfulness meditation. It helps you live in the moment. Stop and smell the roses. Now, as it happens, if you look at the ancient texts on mindfulness, the so-called Satipatthana Sutta, which is kind of the Bible of mindfulness in a certain sense, the foundational text, there's actually no mention of the present at all or living in the moment or anything like that. And in a way, this is a modern emphasis. But that said, it is true that if you do what is prescribed in that ancient guidance and go through and just focus on, pay attention closely to the various things going on in your experiential world, your feelings, your thoughts, your perceptions, the sounds you hear, and so on, then you will find yourself, it's true, you will find yourself living in the moment. So that is a consequence. And you will, there is a kind of a natural appreciation of the beauty of things. You don't have to try. I mean, that was what struck me most on my first meditation retreat was, you know, I'm not an especially aesthetically sensitive person. You know, I'm like, if it's like, where do we go to dinner? I'm like, I just want food. I don't care where we go. But but on the retreat, I was suddenly like this aesthetically appreciative person, and things looked so much more beautiful. I mean, I literally found myself kind of like, I mean, to look at me from a distance, you would have thought I was like caressing a tree. I mean, running my hand over the texture of the bark and just marveling at it. And I wasn't trying to do that. It just happened once, you know, after a few days of fairly intensive meditation. This was my first retreat. I had never really gotten much benefit from meditation before. But after a few days of that, and also, you know, being insulated from the everyday life because I wasn't getting email or anything. That's the state of mind I just naturally fell into, and it's a great place to be.
Yeah, that very first meditation retreat is where that Foreigner song that I played at the beginning got stuck in your head. Up until then, it sounds like your meditation practice had not been very rewarding. Something different happened.
Is that putting it mildly?
Okay,
that is putting it mildly. I mean, I had tried and just thought, okay, I can't do it. I can't focus on 10 consecutive breaths. I mean, I really have attention. I mean, technically, I have attention deficit disorder, not an extreme kind, not the hyperactive kind, but technically I do. So it had never worked at all. Now, for a lot of people, it's easier than it was for me to get into meditation. They can go to a local sitting or try a meditation app like, you know, Headspace or 10% Happier. And they'll find that they're getting into it more easily. But for somebody like me, I did have to do boot camp, you know, a one-week silent meditation retreat. And I recommend this both for people who have meditated and have gotten something out of it and for people who have never been able to get anything out of it because it's an amazing experience. It's not all wonderful by any means. The first 2 days were extremely frustrating. I've recommended this to 10 or so people. All of them have been glad they did it. It's intense. It's not like going to a spa, at least the kinds of retreats I've gone to.
Good to have the warning.
It's austere in some ways. You know, you're not talking. It's silent. You're not talking to anybody. We were meditating 5.5 hours a day, sitting meditation, and another 5.5 walking meditation. And then you listen to a Dharma talk every night, but you're not really doing any talking yourself. There's no news from the outside world, and it's just it's a very intense experience. Not all of it is pleasant, but in my experience, the the unpleasant parts you seem to have been rewarding in the end. I mean, you're naturally going to revisit some issues that are giving you trouble. That's one thing people naturally tend to do, family issues, personal issues. But in my experience, this isn't guaranteed, but I think for the large majority of people, they are valuable things in the long run.
If you've just gotten in on the show, it's a conversation with Robert Wright about his new book, Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. As you hear him talk about his experience with this and the experience that he had of really coming to understand, I guess, the value of meditation on this meditation retreat, I'm curious about whether you've struggled to find clarity through meditation or even just to get in that space where you can meditate. I've experienced that. I find it very, very difficult. I have to be moving, really, to meditate. And from you, what has meditative practice meant in your everyday life? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 to Edith in Northwood, Iowa. Hi, Edith. What's your question?
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hello. Well, I don't really have a question. I have a comment. I've been a Buddhist for 25 years and done a lot of retreats. The premise of your show is how do you cope with the difficulties in our world using meditative practice. Another big underpinning of mindfulness and meditative practice is what's called is sila, which is the word for ethics. And so I think guiding hand of Buddhist ethics is so important in coping with all of our troubled world, and it helps on meditation retreats as well. So that's my comment.
Good to have your call. The ethics of this, Robert, if you'd address that.
Yeah, that's a very good point because, you know, when people ask what I mean, you know, when the title of the book is Why Buddhism is True, and people say, like, what does that mean? I mean, there's a lot of different things in Buddhism. There are different kinds of Buddhism. But I think at the core of Buddhism, pretty broadly speaking, is the claim that the reason we suffer and the reason we make other people suffer is because we don't see the world clearly. We have illusions about ourselves, about other people. Our feelings distort our perception. And when you think about it, that's an amazing claim because it suggests we could kill three birds with one stone. In principle, if you can see the world clearly, start to dispel these illusions about yourself and the world, then you'll become a happier person and a morally better person. And I think that that is broadly speaking true, but it is not guaranteed that if you become a good meditator, you will become a better person. I think it tends to happen, but this point is absolutely correct that the ethics associated with Buddhism are very important to keep in mind on retreat and off retreat. And they're, you know, I think there's in kind of Western, you might say secular Buddhism, which, you know, doesn't get into reincarnation and so on. And my book doesn't get into that. My book is about the naturalistic part of Buddhism, the kind of psychology and philosophy. But in this world of secular Buddhism, I think there's a tendency in some corners, not most maybe, but to think that Buddhism is almost, you know, that it lacks the kind of austere, oppressive moral guidance of like the Ten Commandments. But no, it's a very morally serious endeavor. I mean, first of all, there is the emphasis put on the well-being of all sentient beings, all beings capable of pleasure and pain, which presumably includes non-human animals. And there are strictures like what's called right speech in the so-called Eightfold Path. That's a big part of Buddhism. And, you know, right speech, if you look at it, it's a very challenging thing. It's like, you know, try not to engage in malicious gossip. I find that very hard. I like malicious gossip. So the point I think is a good one that Buddhist meditation is not self-indulgent. It can lead to happiness. I think that's a valid reason to pursue it. But I think the thing I try to emphasize in the book is it can lead to a valid happiness, by which I mean a happiness that is associated with a clearer view of the world and and just better behavior, closer approximation to moral truth.
You've come back around to this a couple times, and this is something I wanted to ask you about that when I read it in the book, I didn't really understand it before we go back to some calls. you describe having access to what you call objective truth about the world when you meditate. I mean, what is that? What is that? I mean, and how do you know you've got it?
Well, I mean, first of all, objective truth as an ideal and a real thing is, and whether that's in the strictest philosophical sense a defensible phrase is something I think we should reserve for a graduate seminar that we may take someday and may just skip. But in any event, I think your question's a really good one. What do I mean when I say you're getting closer to objective truth?
Right.
What I mean is that, like, if you're feeling anxiety about, say, some public presentation you have to give tomorrow, and you're thinking, oh man, I could screw up this way, or I'm going to impress the boss and this will happen. None of that, I mean, that wouldn't be anxiety the latter, but whatever feeling you're having and whatever thought is associated with it, none of that is objectively true. The future hasn't happened. You don't know what's going to happen. And the thoughts that something like anxiety causes you, if you closely examine them, they often have a very limited foundation. Anxiety just tends to carry your mind into these weird areas. So none of that is true. What's true is that you're having this feeling. Mm. So if you just – the feeling of anxiety itself is actually happening. So if you confine your focus to the feeling and just look at the feeling and go, well, where is it in my body? And you appreciate that. That's true. That is where it is in your body. And I suspect that some kind of body scan would reveal that that's where the nerve endings are, mm-hmm. are being activated. So that's true. But the story we add to things, the story we add to the actual objective truth about what's going on in our body is just a story. So that's the practical version of what I mean when I say you can get closer to objective truth.
Okay, so let's use your example real quick here of I have this presentation, I'm anxious about it, I'm meditating, I'm looking at the objective truth that anxiety exists. Is the story that we add to this, well, and I'm anxious because I feel like the boss doesn't appreciate what I do, and this is why this presentation is such a big deal, and it raises, all of the stuff that we tack on to that. That doesn't make any of that less true.
Well, no. And in fact, meditation, like especially on a meditation retreat, but everyday meditation can give you a sense that you have a clearer understanding of why you're having certain reactions. And in general, I'd say that mindfulness meditation just gives you more awareness of the various forces that are pushing and pulling you on a day-to-day basis and how your buttons are getting pressed. Feelings are being activated, and those are leading to thoughts. It gives you much more of an understanding of why you've been doing the things you've been doing. But that said, I would say that delving deeply into the past in a kind of psychoanalytic way, like, oh, this is probably because my father did this to me, that's not really part of mainstream Buddhist practice. Now there are psychotherapists who have fused Buddhist practice with that kind of analysis, and that's fine if it works. But Buddhist practice is much more kind of present-oriented. It does give you a better appreciation of and control over the things that are influencing you on a momentary basis. But it's not psychoanalysis.
Billy in St. Paul called to say, from a language standpoint, meditation is a rest from the chatter in your head. A lot of people are resistant to that. What meditation is a unified experience outside of language. And to the phones here, to Micah in Minneapolis. Micah, it sounds like you do meditate.
I do. Hi, Carrie. How you doing?
Hi. Glad to have your call. How does it work for you?
Yeah. Well, I'm a person living with borderline personality disorder, mm-hmm. and what I do is I do a type of therapy called dialectic behavioral therapy, and in which we practice mindfulness all throughout the study. And what I've come to realize is being in a meditative state isn't necessarily dedicating, for me at least, a block of time throughout my day. Mm. It's little periods of time throughout the day where I sit with my emotions, and I let them pass by and let go of them rather than rejecting them.
Micah, was it hard to understand how to do that in the beginning?
Oh, yeah. I feel like, you know, we have a tendency to be anxious, be depressed, you know, feel all these things in this really big way. You know, I think all humans do. And slowing down and not clearing your mind, but acknowledging that your mind constantly has emotions and feelings running through it. It is very difficult, but I feel like it's like learning a new language. If you implement it every day, all day, it's something that starts to come naturally to you.
I'm so glad to have your call. Robert, he sounds like he's doing precisely what you're talking about in your book.
Yeah, well, and what I said earlier about just wait for the sadness to come or whatever the emotion is, sit down and observe it. Now, I kind of do a combination of these. I do have a 30-minute practice every morning. And then later in the day, there's often another occasion to meditate for just like 5 minutes or something, like if I just can't focus on my work or it's at the end of the day, I'm stressed out, I'm angry, whatever. That's the occasion to sit down and observe whatever is going on. And there is this irony that, you know, you just accept it, look at it, and it tends to lose its grip on you. So I totally support what Mike is doing. I would say that for some people, a regular morning practice will be important because that's the way they'll kind of remember during the day that there's this thing they can do about the problematic feelings. You know, it sounds like he doesn't need that, and that's fine.
I laughed earlier when you said you're somebody who likes malicious gossip because you say in the book, I mean, you're pretty honest with yourself. I don't have a hostile disposition toward humankind per se. In fact, I feel quite warmly toward humankind. It's individual humans I have trouble with. Are you a better person in that way because you've had these experiences with meditation?
Oh, I think I have. And on retreat, I've had dramatic reconceptualizations of people that I had previously, you know, more or less hated, I think you'd have to say. And I've kind of had a completely altered way of thinking about people like that. But it, just having the daily practice, I think, helps me on a day-to-day basis. Things go wrong. There was some confusion, in fact, about where this interview was going to be today.
I know. I thought, geez, we're going to talk about meditation. We put poor Robert through the ringer.
You know, I thought I handled it pretty well, as at least by my own standards of not always handling things well. when you get, you know, angry people, you're in a checkout line and like you really want it to go faster and the person in front of you is like dawdling. I think the daily practice helps remind me that I can just observe the feeling I'm having, the feeling of impatience, the feeling of wrath or whatever, and let it go a little more readily.
To the phones to Mitt. I should apologize for the confusion on the studio.
No, it's a common confusion. There's these two different studios on campus. We needn't get it. I imagine very few listeners need to have this information, but it was no worries. I'm here.
Okay. But it added some drama to your morning. Going back to the phones here to Mitch in St. Paul. Hey, Mitch. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for this discussion. Well, first I want to like a shout out to the last caller. I was raised by a borderline parent, and I'm also in dialectical behavior therapy, and I meditate the same way as him, like 10, 15-minute bursts throughout the day. The question I had was, I wonder if the speaker could speak a little bit about the concept of temporariness and how it relates to the breath, because the guided meditations I do emphasize that everything, thoughts, feelings, distractions, sensations are temporary, and you can literally breathe them out. And I just wonder if you could speak a little bit about the importance of breath in meditation.
Okay. Robert?
Yeah. I mean, it is, first of all, a fundamental tenet of Buddhist philosophy that everything is impermanent, and our failure to appreciate that and acknowledge it and deal with it is the source of a certain amount of our suffering. And, the gratification we seek is not going to last as long as we think and so on. And you're right that the idea of mindfulness meditation, or part of it, is to accept that about your feelings, which can be a real relief if they're unpleasant feelings, right? It's just a feeling. It's showing up. It's going to go away. Now, as for breath, and I should say, not just recognizing that as a conscious fact, you know, just consciously recognizing, oh, it'll go away. You're changing your relationship to the feeling in a way that kind of embodies that fact. But as for breath, you know, breath is the most common way to prepare your mind for mindfulness meditation. It's a way to calm your mind down, because our minds, most of, you know, usually when we're not engaged in a task like reading a novel or doing something on deadline, our minds are wandering.
Right.
What's called the default mode network is active. And it's a kind of a network of in the brain, the default mode network. And it kind of is active when our minds are wandering. And studies have shown that when people meditate, the default mode network gets quiet. And once it gets quiet, then you can start looking at what's going on carefully and calmly. And that includes your feelings and your thoughts and also things going on in the world. And breath is, not just in the Buddhist tradition, but in the Hindu tradition, very common way to start out meditating. That said, it's not the only way to calm your mind. As I said, sometimes you can just go straight to the feeling. And by just saying, I'm going to focus on that, your mind quits wandering around and gyrating, and you just calm down and look at things. But the breath is a very common way to start off. And the idea is that once your mind attains a kind of equilibrium, you are just going to see things more clearly. The things going on inside your head more clearly, and the things going on in the world more clearly. And, you know, in my experience, that's true, that clarity of vision is associated with calm. And the two actually reinforce one another.
Kathleen says on Twitter, and I think this is to Micah, dialectical behavioral therapy, your caller mentioned, saved my life. I'm no longer consumed with suicidal thoughts. And to the phones to Tarun in St. Paul. Hi, Tarun. I'm glad you heard the show.
Yes, thank you.
What'd you want to say?
Yes, I agree with what the speaker is saying. Basically, I personally meditate, and I think meditation is practicing the golden silence, and silence and license are anagrams to each other. Basically, we need a license to do outdoor activities like driving a car or seeing a doctor, but we need a license called silence to practice the inner self. And meditation to me is the process by which we tame the monkey mind and heal the loving heart and know the real self, which is up and above the mind and body, called the soul.
Wonderful. I like the idea of the golden silence, Robert.
Right. Yeah. And I hadn't realized that if you rearrange the letters of silence, you get licensed. So that's very interesting. I certainly agree that with basically everything you said. I mean, there was a twist there that sounded like it may have been a kind of a Hindu twist at the end, describing the soul as rising above. There's a subtle distinction between Hindu and Buddhist philosophy that I won't get into, but I do want to just pause to give credit to Hinduism, because, you know, the Buddha was born a Hindu, and I think people don't realize that a lot of meditative tradition actually originated in a Hindu context, and then a lot of it was kind of formalized in a Buddhist context.
Robert Wright's book is called Why Buddhism is True. You can read more about it on the thread. And thank you very much for an insightful conversation. Good to have you
thank
here.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
You can also read about the books I'm reading and the shows that are coming up at Talking Volumes and all things book on the thread, nprnews.org/thread.